Hello. Welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa with the News Gazette, dated January 14th, Wednesday, 2025. I'm sorry, 2026. Old habits die hard, as we know. Anyway, let's get started on the front page. Today, there's a colorful and large picture of some University of Illinois students with the title, Out for a Glide, and the caption says, Skaters enjoy themselves over the lunch hour at the University of Illinois Campus Recreation Ice Arena in Champaign. A feasibility study on projects needed for the arena is wrapping up, according to Campus Rec Executive Director Justin Peterson, which may lead to a proposal for student fee increase to support the facility, something students expressed support for 2 years ago. In the meantime, the building's lobby has been repainted. The old menu boards have been replaced. The arena's regular schedule includes the lunch skate from 11:15 to 12:15 on weekdays and a freestyle skate from noon to 1 p.m. on Saturdays and a public skate from 1:30 to 4 p.m. Saturdays and Sundays. Other opportunities to get on the ice can be found on the arena's calendar webpage. Then also on the top of the front page, we have an article with a picture of a very large screen and the caption, a rendering of Illinois new Dactronics video board, which will be the largest in college football at 17,315 square feet. And that is quite a picture of this enormous screen. The title of the article is Big Screen Bound at the Geese Memorial Stadium, Illinois to boost the largest video board in college football by Joey Wright. Fans won't have any trouble spotting upgrades to the video boards at Geese Memorial Stadium this fall. Certainly not in the 101-year-old stadium's south end zone, which is set to contain the largest video display in college football. Number one, we get to beat our chest for a while, University of Illinois Associate Athletic Director Daryl Miles said. The other aspect of this will be an attraction. This will be a major change for our fans here at Illinois. The south end zone, it's going to be a monstrosity up there. It's going to be huge. The replacement for the old scoreboard, installed in 2013, will be manufactured by Dactronics and become the centerpiece of 16 LED displays at the stadium that will combine for more than 30 million pixels and 26,750 square feet. Dactronics said via release on Tuesday that the main scoreboard will measure 17,315 square feet, besting Auburn's 10,690 square foot scoreboard by a comfortable margin. As the video guy, one of the things I was most concerned about was the aspect ratio, Miles said, noting that the new board was inspired by the two 21,700 square foot boards at Everbank Stadium in Jacksonville, Florida. So we looked at different size boards that we were working with. I was kind of concerned about when we are placing video on that board. What does it look like? And what does it look when we go to full screen? Illinois will have plenty of space to answer those questions. As we do center video in the middle, the left and the right are going to allow us to put a lot of stats on the board as well as additional content, Miles said. We're playing around with all kinds of things. We're going to pick from all different places in terms of what kind of things we're going to put on the board. Miles said the scoreboard will be one of the handful in the country to run Camino, a 3D rendering software provided by Dactronics for live-to-air graphics. Future-proofing was also a goal of the project, to be completed before the start of the 2026 season. Obviously, you look at the size, Miles said. You look at some of the material you're putting on the board, and you also look at where the industry is going in terms of this board. So this board will be 4K capable, Dextronix is putting together something brand new for us in terms of being able to fire this board and stitch the images together. Purdue's Ross Aid Stadium currently has the largest scoreboard in the Big Ten at 8,461 square feet. These new visual resources reflect our commitment to providing one of the nation's best game day experiences, Illinois Athletic Director Josh Whitman said. Under Brett Bielema's leadership and with an electric fan base that is now filling our stadium to near capacity, our program has become one of the most successful and exciting in major college football. Upgrades to each side of the stadium's displays are also coming soon. We talk about the big boy down in the south end zone. Let's not forget the east and west, Miles said. East and west ribbons are almost going to be twice the size in terms of height that we are currently having. We're also looking at the LEDs in the north side down at the bottom for sponsorship, and then the mega ribbon in the north end zone. Continuing on the front page, an article from Muhammad by Jana Wiersema with the title, Street Parking Creating Snow Removal Headache. Board discussing ways to fix issue to protect both residents and crews. Village staff have asked board members to consider updating Muhammad's snow route ordinance to expand the list of streets where parking on the road is prohibited during inclement weather events. The board discussed the matter during a study session Tuesday night. Public Works Superintendent Eric Crowley said prior to the meeting that the agenda item was just for discussion with no action being taken. He told the News Gazette that implementing a village-wide ban on street parking during the winter weather months is one possibility, but added that staff were looking for the board's direction on how to proceed. We're not trying to put any undue burdens on our residents or anything like that, he said. If anything, we're trying to protect both their private property and our own equipment and make it so that emergency services can get down that street when they need to. Under the current village code, once the local media has been notified that 2 inches of snow have accumulated, parking is prohibited on streets designated as snow routes until notice is issued that parking can resume. The village also announces snow route activation on social media and its website, Crowley said. When the current snow route ordinance is adopted in 2007, the village's population was estimated at 6,500, and many subdivisions, were still in their infancy or non-existent. He wrote in a memo on the board, by comparison, the 2024 census puts the village population at 10,619. Areas currently posted as snow routes include Sunnydale Acres and Northridge Subdivision. Staff posted these areas as snow routes because so many vehicles were being parked on the street and usually parked one vehicle across from another, Crowley wrote. This made snow removal and salting operations extremely difficult, even with a smaller pickup truck. He added that this problem has grown just as the village has grown, and staff were consequently unable to clear at least 6 different streets in a timely fashion during recent snowstorms in November and December of 2025. This was especially bad during the latter weather event on December 13th, which brought about 7 inches of snow. One street we couldn't even get a plow down until Monday, Crowley said, adding that if snow removal crews can't make it down a street, emergency vehicles such as fire trucks are also likely to have trouble getting through. Crowley observed in his report that it seemed like some drivers on the street so that plows do not push snow into their driveways. They park on the street so that the snow plows don't push snow into the driveways. In his 23 years with the village of Muhammad, he has seen 8 accidents involving village equipment and private vehicles during snow and ice removal, and he believes that 6 of these would not have occurred if vehicles were not parked on the street. Staff believes the snow route portion of this ordinance needs to be amended to ban parking on the street after a 2-inch snowfall or other winter weather emergencies, such as freezing rain and ice storms, Crowley wrote. He told the News Gazette that he isn't necessarily looking for a change to occur during this current winter, but is more looking forward to next year and beyond. We also have an insert, which is titled Episode 6, as heard on airing from 4 to 5 p.m. through Monday, WDWS, 1400 a.m., live streaming. It says, 2 decades after making it her Miss America platform, Erica Harold is still standing up for the bullied, both as executive director of the Illinois Supreme Court Commission on Professionalism and in talks that she gives on the sensitive subject. One of the things that's so interesting to me when I talk about this topic, I always expect young people to come up and share with me their experiences. And the pride of Urbana and said Tuesday on News Gazette Radio, but it's often adults who carry the scars of bullying and still sort of see themselves the way they were caricatured and targeted as young people. Once upon a time, Harold was one of those young victims. It was racial and sexual harassment. It's hard to identify what was the catalyst for it, but I think my experience is probably representative of a lot of young people, unfortunately, where you find yourself the target for reasons that are unclear to you. The Harvard Law grad was particularly proud of her commission, issuing a first-in-the-nation report on bullying in the legal profession, which led to the American Bar Association passing an anti-bullying resolution last year. It's something that's been a lot through a line in my whole life, Harold said. I think, unfortunately, as technology continues to progress, we have to be ever vigilant in addressing it. Among the challenges awaiting Tim Colleen's successor in the president's office next year, charting a course for the University of Illinois' future in the age of machine learning technology, says U of I chemistry professor Jeff Moore. Following up on our faculty survey in Tuesday's town hall session, we all hear Al is coming to replace our AI. We all hear AI is coming to replace our jobs. I'm not really worried about AI replacing universities, but it's important that the university not forget that only humans can do certain things. Machines are certainly going to help deliver information and is free from, but wisdom is not. It will not be able to deliver. Also, another bullet point, happy 25th anniversary to Bill Self's 2001 Big Ten title team, which will reunite this weekend in Champaign Calling. The show on the drive-in from Texas, Mahomet native Brammelton said, Brett Melton, spelled funny, it's cool to just see the smiles on everybody's faces and realize that whether you were the best player on the team or just a role player like myself, everybody gets to remember the great moments, and they're all part of it. Continuing under our communities in Section A7, an article that follows that picture on the front page from the University of Illinois by Luke Taylor, with the heading, In the Homework Gathering, Number Crunching Phase. 2 years after students' vote of support, Ice Arena is still looking ahead to possible renovations. In the 2 years since the University of Illinois students took a vote saying they'd be willing to pay more in student fees to see the Ice Arena renovated, it may not appear that much has changed. But behind the scenes, progress keeps on rolling. Campus Recreation Executive Director Justin Peterson said a feasibility study on projects needed for the arena is on the verge of wrapping up. It's currently in the hands of the U of I Facilities and Services Department, who are checking over the details and making sure it fits the university's vision for the 95-year-old building, he said. One thing we've learned, especially in the last year, is that connection to that building. People want to have that building stay where it is, he said. Trying to figure out how to best fit new things and make changes into an existing footprint is kind of a challenge. The student vote supported Campus Rec in bringing a fee increase request to the Illinois Student Council, but Peterson said he's held off on doing so until he was sure on the numbers. I didn't want to go and ask for some money now and then and potentially down the road have to ask for another fee increase or a different fee increase, he said. We're in kind of that homework gathering, number-crunching phase. While Peterson said he hoped to have that finished by now, it's in its final steps. In the meantime, the ice arena hasn't been abandoned. Peterson said that they've seen just as many visitors as in previous years, especially during the busy winter season, and gathering statistics on visitor counts is another incoming project. The lobby has also been repainted, old menu boards have been replaced with video screens, and other small steps are being taken to keep everything up to date as the wait for any major renovations continues. They are things to make it look like we're still caring about the facility because obviously it's being older, it's tough to keep up with everything, Peterson said. First up, the list for the big ticket items might be a new roof, windows, and doors. The roof is from the 1980s and multiple windows have had to be boarded up due to being broken or not completely airtight. Peterson said it's important to seal that off to keep an ice in good shape. The mat under the ice is also reaching the end of its life, and that could possibly be replaced with a newer kind of system that would have concrete directly under the ice. This would give the option to melt the ice out and use the area for other purposes as needed. In his dream world, Peterson would find ways to increase capacity because there are already student groups wanting to use the arena that haven't been able to. I always tell people to do whatever the students want to do with the ice arena, he said. He said, I'll do whatever the students want to do. That could even include building a second rink, theoretically. That's also very challenging in the spot we're in. We're kind of on landlocked on all four sides, so I'm trying to figure out how to best use that facility, and that's important. The arena took a couple of quick holiday breaks this December, but was back on the first weekend of the year. The regular schedule includes a freestyle skate from noon to 1 p.m. on Saturdays and public skate from 1:30 to 4 on Saturdays and Sundays. And that may be an opportunity for folks looking to get more exercise in for the New Year's resolution. The arena is also regularly open for a lunch skate from 11:15 a.m. to 12:45 p.m. weekdays. Anyone who isn't feeling quite ready to hit the ice might just want to wait a few weeks. Beginner Learn to Skate lessons kick off on January 22nd and run for 4 weeks. Registration is already open online and will be through January 15th. The ice arena also remains home for the Fighting Illini hockey team, a registered student organization that mobilized to encourage fellow students to vote to keep the facility. The hockey team will be back before too long with home games against Davenport's University team on January 23rd and 24th. Both games start at 7 p.m., and tickets are available online at $12 for general attendance and $7 for U of I students. And there is another picture of University of Illinois students enjoying the ice. Let's head over now to an opinion piece by our J. Mark Powell in his Holy Cow History. And there is a picture of a locomotive called the City of San Francisco, shown covered in ice and snow after a blizzard trapped the train on the tracks in January of 1952 near the Donner Pass in Northern California's Sierra Nevada. Also pictured, wearing strips of blankets, sheets, and curtains from the train over their shoes, passengers from the City of San Francisco head towards safety after 3 days of being snowbound. And the article begins, "A Train to Nowhere, Snowbound in the Sierras." Gathering there, they say, is half the fun. But one group of travelers would have begged to differ, because what should have been a brief trip, 74 years ago this month, turned into a disaster movie-scale nightmare. Think of it as the perfect storm meets the Donner Party. There was little reason for concern, as 196 passengers and 30 crew members boarded a sleek streamliner train in Chicago, bound for San Francisco-Oakland area, 2,100 miles to the west. True, it was a long voyage, but the travelers were going in style. The City of San Francisco was the pride of the Southern Pacific Railroad. In a time when airfare was grossly expensive and federal interstate highways hadn't yet been built, rail lines offered travelers a third option. The owners made this train as luxurious as possible. The city was the way to go if you had to traverse the North American continent. Railroads often named popular passenger trains after their destination cities back then. Remember the city of New Orleans in Arlo Guthrie's classic 1972 song of the same name? Its many amenities made the 40-hour trip a sheer pleasure. There were reclining seats, sleeping berths with electrical outlets, an in-train phone system, a coffee shop, barbers and manicurists, and an array of rolling eateries offering everything from burgers and fries to formal dining room with steaks and wines served on fine china and crystal atop linen tablecloths, all while clipping along at 110 miles per hour. The ticket costs around $68, plus an additional $20 if you wanted a lower sleeping berth, about $830 in 2026 dollars. $1,100 with the lower berth in today's dollars. Not cheap, but what a way to go. And so powerful, diesel locomotive. This diesel locomotive number 6019 rolled out of the Windy City in January of 1952 and sped right into a blizzard. Not just any blizzard either, but a whopper. And it struck in the worst possible place at the worst possible time. Even in good weather, the stretch of track nearly 7,000 feet above sea level between Sparks, Nevada and Roseville, California, that old-timers derisively called the Hill, was challenging. Advertisements boasted no tougher stretch of railroad in the country. The folks in the city of San Francisco were about to discover just how tough it actually was. A blizzard howled into the area, carried by 100-mile-per-hour winds. Over 3 days, it dumped 12 feet of snow, creating drifts as high as 25 feet in some spots. And that was the very area the city had to pass through on Sunday morning, January 13th. Engineer Tom Sapinor had his work cut out for him. At 11:32 a.m., he slowly started the 15-car train with two extra diesels behind his locomotive for good measure, giving him a combined 6,750 horsepower, heading into the danger zone. It didn't take long for trouble to strike. A 12-foot snowbank gave way, engulfing the city. Sapinor tried every trick in his engineer's book. First, he reversed. Nothing. He tried to inch forward gently. Again, nothing. He tried alternating between the two. "That's it," he finally sighed. "We are stuck." And so began a 3-day ordeal. The passengers stood it fairly well at first. There were bridge games and sing-alongs in the lounge car featuring "California, Here I Come," and what else? "And I've Been Working on the Railroad." As Sunday gave way to Monday, things took a turn for the worse. The city was heated by steam. As the water supply gave out, the 22-degree temperatures outside began creeping inside. Batteries wore out, making the lights first dim and then flicker out. Shivering travelers ripped down curtains and wrapped them around their feet. They smashed wooden furniture and built fires. And then was the matter of using the facilities, with pots and pans pressed into service. The less about that particular hardship, the better. Given the circumstances, it was only natural that some passengers discussed the ill-fated Donner Party from a century earlier. People talked about it quite a bit, one later told reporters. By Monday night, the snow was above the train's windows, making it impossible to see out. The situation was rapidly becoming dire. While all that was going on, rescuers frantically tried to reach the city. 4 snowplows failed. The U.S. Army California Division of Highways and Pacific Gas and Electric Companies all sent rescue teams. In the end, volunteer skiers reached the stranded train and brought food, blankets, and medical supplies. Everybody was bundled up in coats and blankets. Nobody said anything. One rescuer later recalled additional supplies from a derailed supply train eventually arrived by dog sled. After 3 harrowing days, the dazed, shivering survivors were led one by one to a nearby highway and then bused to the next stretch of clear track. There they finished their journey, eventually reaching their destination, not in the lap of luxury as they had started out, but in old rattletrap cars from the 1920s that the railway was planning to scrap. Everybody on board of the city of San Francisco lived to tell the tale. Two heroic rescuers perished trying to reach the worst stranded train disasters in American history. What other disaster does that kind of remind you of? Something involving the deep sea and icebergs, perhaps? Let's go to another opinion piece, this time by Jim Dye. Doctors claim Illinois made a bad trade on the cannabis legalization. The state's Commerce Department recently released its annual cannabis report for 2025, its 10-page summary providing an effusive description of the economic benefits of the 2019 legalization. It cited the state's accomplishments of the past year, one being empowering members of minority groups to become successful entrepreneurs in the business, and outlined 2026 goals. Suffice it to say, it's touted the wonderfulness of it, the legalization movement sweeping the country. But there was another report released, a 168-page examination of the social consequences of legalization that was prepared by a health advisory committee. That fact-filled tome prompted two physicians, Corey Franklin and Gerald Lichen, to conclude that Illinois exchanged public health for profits. Since recreational cannabis became legal, the state has realized hundreds of millions of dollars from taxes. This windfall and the attendant political benefits for the governor have come at public expense as the dangers of marijuana have become tragically apparent, they wrote in Chicago Tribune commentary. The Health Advisory Committee report states that 7.7% of Illinois adults reported frequent use in 2023, up from 6.8% in 2021-22, and slightly above the national average. Members of that group were said to have a likely cannabis use disorder. A slightly lower figure, 6.9%, met the medical criteria for cannabis use disorder in 2023, compared with 6.5% in 21-22. Here's another not surprising statistic. 6.9% of Illinois youth aged 12 to 17 reported initiating cannabis use in the past year, rebounding to pre-legalization levels. Of adult smokers, 10% have sought medical attention to deal with adverse reactions to cannabis. More than 30% suffered from uncontrollable vomiting as a consequence of chronic use. Another regular diagnosis, cannabis-induced psychosis, affects consumers' mental health. There is a long list of adverse effects, including one finding that cannabis is especially common in those with severe mental illness. It's a self-medicating phenomenon. In addition to citing increased revenues, legalization proponents argued it would eliminate the illegal black market, but that continues to flourish because private leaders charge lower prices. Outright legalization was preceded by a lobbying campaign that pitched marijuana as a cure for a wide variety of serious health issues. That, too, is an effective but false argument. The American Medical Association summarized years of research, concluding that evidence is insufficient to support claims that cannabis addresses most medical indications. Perhaps that's why nearly 90% of Illinois purchases were for recreational use in 2024. The doctors concede the ship has sailed on the public acceptance of legalization. President Donald Trump recently boosted the movement by ordering the Federal Drug Administration to recategorize marijuana into a category indicating a low potential for harm. The doctors prescribed the Trump-Pritzker Alliance as a national bipartisan debacle. Before marijuana was legalized, it was decriminalized, reducing, if not eliminating, its status as law enforcement priority. The prospect of new review from legalization, however, provided an irresistible incentive to go beyond decriminalization, first medical marijuana, and then outright legalization. And we're going to stop here for this half of the News Gazette. I will be returning shortly.